Michael and I'm a member of the ICANN board. There has been quite a bit of discussion in the ICANN community, especially since, I think, Brussels, on the GNSO recommendation number 6. And that recommendation was looking at something which I think has now changed its name, but the general topic is around public interest issues with potential new GTLD strings. A working group was formed, and that working group had participation from just about everyone. It had the GNSO in it, it had ALAC, it had the GAC, so I mean, it's a great cooperative effort. I'll cover them all. And certainly the GAC has been able to provide feedback from what a public interest from a government perspective. ALAC has given some views on how users might be impacted, and members of the GNSO have given views on how it interacts, particularly with the original work in the new GTLD policy forum. So I guess one of the things that had kicked off, if we can jump to the board resolution on recommendation 6. One of the things the board wanted to make very clear, because there has been some concern that where does the board fit into the process? Certainly from our perspective, the new GTLD process consists of a number of dispute resolution forums. So there's a dispute resolution around problems with string similarity. We have dispute resolution for trademark issues, and we have dispute resolution for the recommendation 6 or the public interest strings. And in each of those, there's an independent process that makes a decision on whether a particular dispute or protest is upheld. But ultimately, the board does bear responsibility for the whole GTLD program, and certainly we are, the buck stops with us. We're not trying to remove responsibility, but fundamentally our position in the Trondheim meeting was that we would continue to rely on these dispute resolution forums. That was really the main board discussion in Trondheim. And other than that, the board had said that it had read the report, thought there were many good suggestions in that report, and encouraged staff to work closely with the working group to implement as many of those suggestions as possible. So certainly some of them would have found its way into the proposed final guidebook. And one of the purposes of this session is to find out, well, what additional material could be incorporated into the guidebook. Maybe there's some areas where the working group, well, there was areas that weren't clear to perhaps the staff as to the intent of the working group. And we're also certainly, as a board member, interested to hear what the community thinks about the current implementation of this in the guidebook and certainly the community's views on the suggestions from the working group. So that's the context. And if we jump to the first question, I guess, which is the role of the board. Certainly I'm interested perhaps hearing briefly from the panellists here, and perhaps they can introduce themselves, I'll do it quickly. We have Frank March, who's a member, he's from New Zealand government, but also a member of the Government Advisory Committee. We have John Nevitt, who's been involved in the GNSO, particularly from the registrar perspective. Have Cheryl Landonor and Evan Levovich, that are both involved in ALAC within ICANN. So handing over to you, if anyone on the panel wants to comment on this question one, role of the board. Frank?
Actually, Bruce, it's not so much a question one. I just wanted to correct an impression you may have given inadvertently. The GAC's part in the working group was on the part of individual members only. I certainly, and there were three of us, I think, or four, who contributed at one point or another. We were contributing as individual representatives of our governments and members of the GAC, not on behalf of the GAC. And the GAC has not actually had an opportunity to discuss these recommendations. But I just want to make that clear. Thanks.
Bruce, while we're correcting things, I think it's fairly important in the context here that, you know, these things get transcribed and people suddenly take them as facts, so let's make sure the facts are correct. Things were going on long before Brussels, and it may be that some of us weren't aware of it, but in fact both the GAC and the ALAC have had long-standing concerns and objections to a number of issues in the ever-growing numbers of DAGs. We go back to the original, do we not, Frank? And I'm sure we can both talk on that ad nauseum, but that's not the purpose of today. It's the morality and public order, what we have changed in our discussions to Recommendation 6. Informally, there was a meeting in Nairobi between representatives of the Government Advisory Committee and the at-large community, regions, etc., and there's been a lot of back-end discussion about how we can ensure that without holding up in any way, shape or form the program of getting new GTLDs out, because certainly ALAC has been a supporter of the need for them. So things have to be done in a timely manner. How we could grapple with some of the implementation issues of what was the policy. And so to that end, it was the GAC and the GNSO and the ALAC, which is why you've got three representatives here from those spaces, that put together a terms of reference body for a cross-community work group, and then the work began, the output of which, of course, you did discuss, and we certainly appreciate the instructions to staff, and a bit of work, a very good work, has gone on since then to make sure we can have some clarifications and next questions. That said, if I can go alphabetically, because I've got to go to another function, which is why Evan is going to become Cheryl shortly, to answer your role of the board, there was an awful lot of discussion in the cross-community work group about our concerns to ensure that when things were being on the very thin ice stage, not the easy things, we certainly don't expect, desire or want the board to be involved in an operational sense in these day-to-days. But when something has come out of that pathway, when it has gone through a process of whatever form of assessment, internal, external, or by the gods and goddesses themselves, that someone on the board needs to say, the majority of us do believe this is or is not advice we wish to take. So that was certainly from an ALAC and at large perspective what we were meaning by the role of the board, and I guess the others should respond.
Thanks, Bruce. First of all, from a GNSO perspective, this effort was certainly sponsored by the GNSO as well as ALAC and the GAC, but it hasn't received any kind of validation or vote from the GNSO. So these are recommendations from the working group and from the perspectives of the members of the working group. And to Frank's point, it was incredibly helpful to have Frank and a couple of the other GAC members on the group, on the working group, and part of the discussion. So thank you, Frank, for participating, because we wouldn't have had that perspective otherwise, and we hadn't had in the past. With that said, the GNSO now is entertaining the series of recommendations to see if there's they want to approve it as a group or not, or just pass it on to the implementation team as part of the process. So thank you.
Okay, and now just open up to the floor if anyone wants to comment on this particular question of the role of the board in this matter of Recommendation 6. No? Okay. The next one then was the incitement to discrimination. Yep. I guess what we have here, I'm just trying to read it because I've got a printed version, but it's much smaller font. So we basically have a number of categories, I guess, under the topic of discrimination. And so the guidebook incorporates race, colour, gender, ethnicity, religion or national origin. It seems the working group had, looks like a longer list as opposed to a different list. And so perhaps would anyone on the panel like to comment on why some of those additional items should be incorporated into the guidebook?
Thanks, Bruce. Do you want to introduce Peter, or do you want to say anything? Okay. So on behalf of the working group, we had a consensus position that extended some of these discriminations to include additional ones such as age, disability, sexual orientation, gender identity, or political or other opinion. So we didn't reject any. We stuck with what was in the applicant guidebook, and then we added some. Remember that any of these have to be, according to the recommendations, they must violate principles of international law. So that's a very important factor, and if there are principles of international law that impact these discriminations, then they would be taken into account, and if they don't exist now or yet, and that's fine. So that would be something that an expert panelist would advise the ICANN board upon.
No, I'm happy to say that that was perfectly covered. Thanks, John. It was definitely consensus, though.
Are there any comments or questions on this list of additional items? No, they're not in the guidebook, Peter. They're proposals. Yeah, the left is what's in the guidebook. The right is what's not. Yeah, Kurt, actually, could you? That would be fantastic. If you could explain, maybe provide a staff's perspective on some of these additional elements and why they were not incorporated into the latest version of the guidebook, that would be helpful.
Yeah. No, I won't. Test. Okay. So, I want to make two points. One is when we had our interaction with the working group, and we discussed this. Clearly, there were there's two camps in the whole on this whole issue. One is that would like to see fewer restrictions on domain names, so less names objected to, and others that would like to see that broadened, that would like to see the definition of discrimination broadened. So when we asked the clarifying question to the working group, we were recognizing that clearly some members of the working group seek to narrow the number of objections that will be successfully upheld, but increased standard clearly broadens the number. So that's where we're kind of checking on the lack of consensus. And then the second point I have is this, that, and Amy or Dan would do a much better job than I, but when these standards were formulated, they were a definition of what is in violation of international principles of law, if I said those words in the right order. So surveying different nations in all the different regions, it was found that across those different regions, incitement, discrimination with regard to race, color, gender, ethnicity, religion, or national origin was. So de facto, you know, if there's discrimination based on that, you don't have to make an additional inquiry if it's violative of international law. So when we read the CWG recommendations, we were at the same place we were before, and we said that the group was defining discrimination based on political opinion as a violation of international law. And so we saw that as a very broad standard. So to keep the inquiry narrow for the dispute resolution providers, the standards are, if you find one of any of these three things, right, incitement to discrimination, incitement to child pornography, incitement to violent lawless action, if you find any one of those, you have found a violation of principle of international law, and you're done. You don't have to make another inquiry whether that is so. And what I'm understanding the working group to say, I'm talking too much, is that, you know, if you find discrimination with political or other opinion and then find that it's a violation, so I think that's it's a hard way to make the standard work. So that's why we stuck with this. And if we go to a broader stand, you know, one, I think staff might agree to add some of these because it's in some jurisdictions of the world, although it would be different than an international standard. But we're very concerned with the way the current tests work. If we put some others like political opinion, allow you to not get a domain name because of your political
Just to make it really clear, as we were discussing in the cross-community work group, what we were aiming to do is not set these up as principles that will stop people getting domain names. These are principles upon which people may raise an objection. It still has to hold water. It still has to be a reality. And I think what we're also losing here is the fact that these things were coupled in our report, and the use of not just incitement but actual instigation does narrow that field significantly as well. So we do need to be careful that we're not decoupling things that in the recommendations of the cross-community work group were coupled for very good reasons. And when you refer to what appears to be a difference in opinion from what is a consensus report to variations on the theme, it's often with the coupling or decoupling of other things that acted as safeguards to assure the community that was in the cross-community work group that their needs were being met. So we just need to be careful here on that. Evan, you drafted the response to the questions. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I was just saying that if you're going to talk about the stuff on the right-hand side as increasing the number of objections, I'd say you'd also have to go along with the fact that adding the word instigation narrows it also significantly. Mm. So I'm curious to know why you didn't allow for that in the comparison as well.
You want to answer that? Good.
How do you define instigation, I guess, is the first. Your point only works if you've got a really good definition of instigation and it has quite a high threshold of activation. Is there a definition of instigation?
We wanted to leave that to the analysis of the experts doing the comparison against international law. We didn't want to constrain it that way. We simply said within the working group that we wanted to allow that as a criteria that would help to narrow things. We were hoping it would.
So the reason we did not couple them is this, that picture a domain name, if you can, that is an incitement to commit child pornography. So if you take that as a fact, then you couldn't uphold an objection because it might not be an incitement and an instigation. So we were worried. You know, look, do incitement and instigation mean the same thing almost, you know? So I don't know if that's a parsing. But anyway, that's why we kept them decoupled, was we saw a possible bad result.
Sorry, Peter Dengate Thrush coming in a bit late, and I have to say I've got my mind a little bit confused on this. I'm not in a camp that, and I think most of the board is not interested so much in the issue of whether it broadens or narrows. Most of what we're interested in, is it predictable? Are you going to know from the beginning, is this predictable, and is there an objective standard which someone can measure themselves against so that they don't waste their money, and once they get into the process so they can be have an outcome that's predictable? So that's more where we're coming from than any broadness or narrowness issue. And what we did originally, and I really this is a question to Kurt, we said breaches any of the, and forgetting about the language, which we're happy to have been corrected about, but breaches any of these international standards that the world has agreed. And then we came up with a category four, I think it was in the Vienna workshop, that said, or any other similar principle that gets developed between now and the time this sort of goes live. So you don't have to go and create a whole lot of, you know, list every possible internationally acceptable breach. So if there's an international treaty that suddenly comes out for the protection of New Zealanders against abuse, then that becomes, you know, one of them, and we sorely need it. But, you know, in other words, don't try and make a definitive list here. Just say, so I'm just wondering what's happened to that kind of thinking, either by the group or by the staff.
Well, it was already anticipated in the work that we did within the group that we weren't going to be anticipating every possible treaty that's going to be happening in the future. We simply had seen some of the kinds of perceived instigations and objectionable things that we'd seen. Things like sexual orientation we have seen now is starting to become illegal in certain jurisdictions, and there's efforts to do treaty work on this. So we saw that this was something that was worth putting in. There still has to be a standard applied of, at the time the evaluation is done, does it go against the international law and treaty? The experts would be asked to do an evaluation based on the status at that moment. If there are treaties that that make that enforced, that allow you an analysis that says something goes against international law at that moment, then that's in line with it. We simply saw what was happening in some jurisdictions that does include some things on that extra list.
I don't understand how that can be sensible, that you put in a clause that lists a possible abuse and gives the right to stop an application, create an objection process, send it off to an evaluator who then sends it back and says, well, there isn't a law on this yet. Why would you go through that process?
Peter, if there wasn't a law on it, it wouldn't get to that point, because that would be the... It's a quick look first. So it wouldn't even go down that pathway. It would fail a quick look. It still has to, any of these things still have to have the basic tests applied to them. One thing, much of the conversation that we had adding these, and John, please, Frank, don't let me monopolise up this end of the table, because you know I'm likely to. But we did talk to Carol and have his expertise brought into our conversations. And one of the things we thought we were doing was basing on one of the examples he was giving us as to why some of these things were very important. There was a phrase, and again, these things get decoupled, and our thinking was coupled to a number of recommendations. There was another recommendation where we talk about the content versus the string. And it's not being discussed in these questions, but we were very particular that we wanted the string looked at, not the potential content of what the string may or may not intend. And he countered with us on that part of the conversation where the use of a kill a particular insect, which you and I would have absolutely no problem with and probably would be a very valid GTLD for, you know, an insect eradication company that specialises in this particular thing, was highly offensive to a whole race of people, and it was actually able to be proved as a incitement to the discrimination rule. So, you know, these things, we didn't just jump in and want to add a few of them. If we can't get those ones, that's certainly... I'm not going to die in the gutter over the addition or restriction of those. Let's perhaps get onto some of the meatier issues.
Dear Cheryl, I think we've got the gist of that. So I think question three, if we can have that one up. This one's probably one of greater interest, which is the working group had recommended that GAC and or ALAC would have the ability to submit community objections, I guess, as an advisory committee. And then the issue is if that was allowed, who would pay the costs? Is that ICANN paying the costs or somehow the advisory committee is raising funds? What the rules would be for when the GAC and ALAC would do that. In other words, do they have to show that they have consensus within their advisory committee before they would raise an objection? And also the working group had proposed potentially a lower standard to be used for objection.
Let me just clarify that, Bruce. There was divergence on the lower standard,
yes,
so that slide is probably not as clear as it could be in that. The measured against lowered standards, there was no consensus on that issue. It would be the same standard that everyone else would.
Okay. So I'll leave it open for anyone here to propose that as to why they think that would be the case.
I'm not going to do that. Can I just mention something, just speaking entirely personally? What I've never understood is what the rationale for this is, and I've tried to get that across in a couple of other conversations. I come from a legal jurisdiction where occasionally the Crown or, you know, the government, when it acts, and I come from a loser-pays kind of jurisdiction, but even if the Crown takes a case and loses, sometimes there are conditions under which it doesn't have to pay the costs of losing if it can argue that it has been bringing a case sort of in the public interest. I can work my way through to a situation where there might be an argument that GAC or the ALAC are acting as the defenders of the public interest in bringing this case, and they haven't done it for their own. It's not because one of their members acting; it's they're doing it. So I'd like to hear whether I'm groping in the dark around the right sort of. What are the reasons for this? I guess is the question.
Let me emphasise that many of these recommendations have not been, none of them have been considered in the GAC in the present form. Let's be quite clear about that. In this particular case, though, there was a very, very strong feeling which, on the part of the GAC, which had discussed the issue of payments for objections, that objections brought by governments should not be, or at least recommended by the GAC, should not be at the cost of any particular government. And that was a strong feeling of the GAC. There are various levels of objection to this, but the main point, I think, from this area is if the GAC is making recommendations, providing advice to the board, that would take the form of it could place an objection as an advisory capacity to the board, and that would not raise the situation of cost to any individual government. But the mechanism by which that would be done has not been discussed in the GAC, so I can't give a GAC response to that.
Sorry, can I just get that clear? So you're saying that instead of, because it can't give advice in relation to individual TLDs as they go through, if it could, it wouldn't have to pay for that. So if it has to go through an objection process instead, it shouldn't have to pay for that either. Well, I'm not.
The case of an objection would be a form of advice.
I'd like to propose an objective advisory in that case. Do you think the GAC would be okay with some number of unpaid objections as opposed to an unlimited number of unpaid objections? Because it could, you know, it just could go on, and that's the worry, I think, of some people.
Again, I'm not answering on behalf of the GAC, but the GAC is a highly responsible body, sensitive to the issues that before I can, and would not raise frivolous objections. If it's providing advice to the board, it does so on a very, very considered, careful basis. I think that would impose its own limitations.
And just on the same basis we're talking on this particular question, it does say the ALAC and the GAC to perhaps be able to use the community objection process. We would be taking the basis for consensus to bring such an objection forward at a very high level indeed. It would certainly not be something that should be swamping a system. And remember again, we don't want to play our card or our voucher. We'll talk about vouchers. I like the vouchers idea. Our voucher is not going to be run through for something that's going to be vexatious or not get through the first lookup. It would have to be a high barrier.
So, Cheryl, can you clarify for the community on ALAC what its process would be on consensus, just so we're clear? Because I think people are concerned that maybe the any individual GAC member, ALAC member raises something and that becomes an objection. So I assume you're talking
Absolutely
about some process.
Not.
Could you
Absolutely
very quickly
not.
Summarise the process?
Well, the process, and we haven't envisaged it in full, but we would expect that this would come actually from our EDGE community, that we would have an at-large structure that would convince the other at-large structures in its region, and its region would convince the other regions to convince the ALAC that this is a bona fide community objection. The ALAC would then have a vote and decide yay or nay to bring it forward.
And is that vote a majority or supermajority or consensus?
That would be a supermajority vote.
Thank you.
And Frank, presumably the same applying in the GAC. We're not talking about an individual GAC member being able to call itself the GAC. It would have to be the GAC itself taking a majority decision or a consensus position or something.
All I can say to that is I would expect so. Because, as I say, this has not been discussed in the GAC, and the GAC, in fact, is still coming to terms or discussing the nature of, it's part of the review team too, is the nature of advice of the board. It is still a little bit up in the air, and I can't really provide it. The GAC does not vote, so there's no question of a supermajority. We're talking about consensus.
Yeah, Jonas Honen, TLG liaison to the board. Just to clarify this, I think you just answered it, but the thing is that the no cost would be for GAC, not an individual government raising an objection. Yeah, GAC is whole. That's a good thing. Then I had another question, but I think I am having a senior moment, though being quite young still.
Protect against discrimination on age there.
thank you. The other thing was basically about the process. So you said that the GAC objection would come as a form as of an advice to the board or as an objection to the objection process.
In terms of the the working group did not look at that particular. What I'm describing is a possible mechanism by which the GAC itself, and my advice to the working group was that the GAC strongly objected to the idea that it's, that governments would pay for lodging an objection. The outcome of that was this recommendation in terms of GAC, but it actually coincided very closely with what the at-large advisory committee also felt about its members.
Yes, that wasn't quite what I asked. I had a little bit of a different topic. So the question, what you discussed there on the panel for a little while was that how would GAC send that send that objection? And I think you said that that would be as an advice to the board.
That's my opinion. It is not a solid. It's not something the recommendation six working group could give advice on, and the GAC itself has not discussed it.
Okay.
So at the moment, that's a hanging question.
Yeah. Just to kind of for the record, I kind of like find that a little bit strange, a little bit difficult that it gives advice to a board when there is an objection mechanism in the so. That is something that should be then thought of.
If I can buy in from an ALAC perspective, we would feel most uncomfortable from our perspective, just nothing to do with the GAC here. What we were trying to do in the Recommendation 6 Cross-Community Workgroup was find ways that in the existing system we could find implementation tools and triggers to meet the concerns and needs that our community have brought forward that were not being met. So the framing of this particular recommendation was very much to ensure that we simply inserted ourselves in the normal processes.
I guess I'm a bit mystified by a lot of this discussion and the staff answer to this original proposal from the working group that the cost could not be waived. Given the enormous budget that discretionary budget that ICANN allocates to ALAC and GAC, I'm waiting for the laughter. There's no way we can pay any money anyway. So if you say we need to pay money, you're simply saying that this was a sham, that you put the ALAC and GAC there as able to submit objections, but it's never going to really happen. We know it won't really happen. We're hoping you don't notice that we put it there with no real merit.
The obvious answer to that is the budget is created by the community and approved by the community, and once you've got a demonstrable need for funds for this, put it in the budget and get a community vote to say, we need money for this. Let's not get tangled up in knots about historic lack of budget. We haven't had this requirement before. We now have. Bring it forward. Get your mates in the community to support it, and there it goes into the budget.
Noted. But I wouldn't put a lot of my money on it happening.
I have a question from the chat room from Carol Dorgan. He asked, if the GAC or ALAC are not required to pay the cost of the objection proceedings, who would pay their share of the costs?
Just in the spirit of disclosure, if there were... I can see this going through in this kind of way. I don't have any difficulty, as I say. If the ALAC and GAC go through a process like we've described so that it's clearly a it's their community position, and they can argue that it's in the public interest, they are internal organs of ICANN. They're not like external strangers to the process coming along for commercial interest of their own. So personally, I'm just letting you know, I'm quite inclined, if this is carefully drafted, I've no objection with the principle.
Have we done this one?
But lower standards I don't understand either. Why is that with... No, okay.
No one's proposing lower... Anyone want to defend lower standards? Good.
Could I explain why those words are even on there? Because it was very specific in the recommendation discussions that the lower standards might be that in the situation of GAC, it may want to have a situation that if they have a single member bring through a issue, there was some issues there that left us with that, but there was no consensus and endorsement in the group on that at all.
So the next set of questions, number 4, which is, I think, is the last one, is that right? Yes, it is. The concept of the independent objector. And so then one of the issues was, and I think staff had raised this partly, that the independent objector is intended to be independent. So that there were suggestions around this from the working group. Kurt, perhaps from a staff perspective, you could just give a bit of clarity around, one, how the independent objector is actually set up in the dispute resolution processes, and how there's a difference between how the staff have implemented this and what the working group might have suggested.
I'll start, and then maybe our legal team can correct me. So from the creation of the independent objector was really based on public comment to the first guidebook, and went to the issue of what if there's a, let's just call it for sake of argument, a clearly objectionable string. That is a string that we all in the room would agree that if objected to would be blocked, the application would be blocked. And it was thought that the creation of an independent objector then could wade through the objection process, and then if that person identified a string as clearly objectionable, it could lodge a objection in the public interest. And just to talk too much about it, there are some safeguards wrapped around it. The independent objector is accountable. Their performance is reviewed. If he or she makes objections, are they upheld as a rule? So there's periodic reviews of the independent objector regarding his or her performance. It's a person completely independent of ICANN that would lodge objections with the dispute resolution provider and be funded by ICANN. So I read the working group report a month or so ago, and I'll screw this up so you guys can help me. But saw the independent objector as someone who would aid the ALAC and GAC in their lodging of objections and lodge objections on behalf of ALAC and the GAC. And so to the extent that's correct, there were other roles. To the extent that's correct, we saw the ability to furnish the services that were requested in the report. So there's ways to satisfy the requests in the report that are kind of different from the role of independent objector as we've seen it, but we see it as somewhat of a different role.
So perhaps if I can clarify that, Kurt, if what I'm hearing you saying is that the independent objector wouldn't be acting on behalf of a single organ, so they wouldn't be acting on behalf of ALAC, or they wouldn't be acting on behalf of GAC. An independent objector is independent and makes an objection on their own behalf.
So the way it was envisioned in the guidebook is that ALAC or GAC, GAC advice or ALAC could work with the independent objector, but the way it's in the guidebook right now, the independent objector makes the decision whether or not to lodge the objection, not the ALAC or GAC. And before, we talked about the ability for ALAC or GAC to lodge objections.
So with that as clarity, perhaps if we can get a comment from Cheryl or the ALAC perspective and the other panellists on whether that differs from your perspective.
The GNSO members of the group were somewhat neutral on this and went along with the flow on this, but that was a very well articulated, well thought out, well presented reason why the recommendation that we came up with might want to be rethought.
Yeah.
And from a higher level, having that perspective earlier in the process would be incredibly helpful. So when we have these cross community working groups or working groups to get the input, instead of coming up with a final report or and then getting an ICANN response, trying to weave that ICANN response into the working group earlier would be very helpful, because this recommendation I don't think would have gotten consensus at that point with that knowledge, because that makes sense, at least from my perspective. I don't know about from the ALAC and GAC perspectives, but coming up with another vehicle for doing that as opposed to jeopardizing the independence of the independent objector probably was not the goal of the group in that instance, and there might be a different vehicle for that. So thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Did you want to comment, Councillor?
Are you going to go, Evan? Go on, Evan. Off you go.
I guess what's happened is that we've seen the independent objector, and I'll be just kind and say, is not sufficiently independent for what we were thinking. And I would disagree with the position that you've just heard in the sense that I think that the path of going through the ALAC and GAC was necessary. And if, in fact, it totally replaced the independent objector, it wouldn't bother us at all because we see the IO position as becoming less transparent, less accountable, and we, in fact, think that doing this through the GAC and ALAC forces a level of transparency that might not otherwise be available. And
So Evan, what I think I'm hearing is that both options are available. So from the earlier discussion we were talking about the GAC ALAC point, I think there seems to be support for having an ability for GAC or ALAC to raise an objection, or an independent objector can raise an objection. And you're not forced to go through the independent objector, nor are you forced to rely on the independent objector. So is that clear?
Close enough.
Yeah. Robin?
I'm Robin Gross with the Non-Commercial Users Constituency and Stakeholder Group. I just wanted to make a couple comments about the concept of the independent objector and particularly the way in which it has been drafted, created by staff in the documents. I think it's worth pointing out that it wasn't a GNSO recommendation. It wasn't something that went through the GNSO process. It came entirely from staff, so it doesn't really have the GNSO's approval on it. And I also think that there's some logical problems with this concept of an independent objector. I mean, we're talking about strings that everyone in this room would agree on shouldn't be allowed to happen, yet nobody has objected. So this is actually illogical. If it is something that is so horrible that everyone agrees it's terrible and we can't have it, why has nobody objected? Nobody in the world, no religion, no business, no company, no individual, no community. Nobody's objected, and yet this is supposed to be something that we all agree is objectionable. So I find the whole concept somewhat illogical. And I also have problems with the transparency issue. We were told in our meetings, in this the CWG meetings by the attorney that ICANN hired to work on this, that one of the reasons ICANN wanted the independent objector was so they could allow secret objections from governments who might not want to make these objections go public. And so, you know, obviously this kind of stood the hair on the back of my neck right up. We have transparency problems here. If somebody's going to object, they have to be able to say, I'm going to object. There has to be somebody who's going to say, I will be harmed. So that was another thing that the group talked about adding into the independent objector process, but staff dismissed, which was this idea that you actually have to have somebody who will say, I will be harmed, in order to actually have an objection go forward. We can't just have this imaginary. There must be somebody out there who might not like this and will be harmed. We actually have to have an individual or a company or a community or somebody who will stand up and say, I will be harmed by this if it goes forward. And without that, it just seems like this independent objector process is dangerous, insidious, very little transparency, and open to gaming and open to lobbying. The independence is problematic for me because I see it as being not independent from ICANN. And so when objections come in, the independent objector really works for ICANN. And so I don't see the independence issue the way that others see it as, well, independent from the parties. I feel like it should be independent from ICANN in the sense that, you know, we've been told in this community working group that now risk mitigation is a new policy goal. And so anything that might cause a risk for ICANN, we can just knock out because of risk mitigation strategies, never mind what's actually in the best interest of the Internet. So these are just a few of the problems that I have with the independent objector process and that the way that it was envisioned by staff and not allowed to be changed in any way at all by staff. So
I might just get a bit of a staff response from that, but certainly I think our perspective from a board isn't the fact that there's some secret, you know, someone can, they're acting on behalf of some secret party. But anyway, perhaps the staff can just explain the concept of the independent objector, and I might get Peter, who's our legal expert, around here to explain it to me.
Thanks, Bruce.
So I think Robin gives a stirring defense of why this process seeks to use independent dispute resolution providers and not leaves the issues on each of these objections with the board. All her comments about independence subject to lobbying being swayed inside ICANN. That's the very reason why this process uses independent dispute resolution providers.
So there's a difference between the dispute resolution provider and the party that's raising the dispute. So I think Robin's particularly saying, why do we have an independent party raising a dispute?
So that was just an appositive to the answer, which is we think, you know, in our discussions, we think there are real opportunities for objectionable strings that will not be objected to by governments, either because they don't officially recognize an entity and so they're unable to object to it, or other political reasons for not objecting. And we see that as a real possibility of it happening. We think there are procedural guidelines or procedural protections that can be put in place in order for us to ensure that the independence is maintained, some sort of barriers to communication. And finally, you know, Robin describes, you know, addressing risks, and that's what we do. We're seeking to address risks to the process, and the downside to the new GTLD process of a string where governments clearly object to it but won't object being put in the root is very great. It's a very great risk to the process, because then governments will use processes outside of the ICANN process in order to ensure that doesn't happen. So that's a risk we're trying to address.
I find Robin's arguments quite compelling in relation to transparency and just simply the standing requirement. What's the standing of the objector? Are you saying, Kurt, that they would act under the directions of this government or other party that doesn't want to act by itself, or are they doing it because of the inaction of that party? Amy.
If I might, Peter.
Please.
The idea is that the independent objector would act on behalf of the public. So it wouldn't act on behalf of any particular entity or government, would be acting on behalf of the public interest, and therefore would step into the shoes of having standing of somebody who would be harmed in that regard.
Yeah, and I think what Robin's saying, if I heard correctly, is that that should be based on some evidence. Is that right? In other words, some form of evidence that the public is concerned about this issue before the independent objector.
And I certainly think one of the key factors that we have taken into consideration is understanding that the public comment forum is going to be a major avenue for the independent objector to determine whether or not there is harm to the public interest. And, you know, there's a lot of mechanisms that we can create to make sure that those get to the, in a transparent manner, maybe on a separate public forum, that goes to the independent objector where ALAC or GAC or whomever says, this is wrong and you need to object. And our instruction, I think, from the community would be to the independent objector, you need to pay very careful attention to that.
Thanks, Bruce. Just one thing, because I know this session is being transcribed, that the some of these recommendations were definitely discussed in the working group, but they did not achieve consensus. There was divergence on changes to the IO. Now, that's not taking anything away from you know, Robin's ideas, and I absolutely think she should file public comment, and any other group should do that as well. But to Amy's point, I think the discussion that we had related to the independent objector was that it would monitor this public list, so that way the folks that Robin mentioned, the businesses, the anyone else that might have an objection to this, but they don't want to take the next step of paying a fee, being a litigant in a dispute resolution process, they have an avenue to raise their voice and raise their hands, and someone will pick that up and run with it. So I think that was the intent. Now, with the transparency and the rationale and the linkage between those complaints and the independent objector, those, as Robin says, need to be buttoned down maybe a little better than they are now, and hopefully that'll happen in the final. Thank you.
I think part of the problem that At Large has had with this also is because of the huge expense of complexity of having a litigation program in place for the DRSP anyway. If you'll notice, the working group was very careful not to use even the terminology for DRSP. It was explicitly left out of the recommendations. There's nothing at all in what the committee did that compels the kind of litigation-based resolution that is envisioned. As a matter of fact, there was an explicit role for the experts who were anticipated to have skills not in making morality judgments between two different litigants, but to make analysis based on law. This was something that was a consensus thing. And ALAC has always had a problem with the idea of outsourced morality judgments. And it was our hope that by saying you have an expert panel, the expert panel makes analysis based on law, not listening to two people and say who's got the better moral right, we thought was a better approach to dealing with this from the get-go. And if you take this system of making it an analysis-based system as opposed to a litigation one, you dramatically reduce the cost. You dramatically reduce the complexity. So it helps with things on a number of different levels, including whether or not you need to do something through the IO.
Any other comments on this question? No? I think we've pretty much come to the end. Are there any other... Anyone want to make any closing remarks or comments, or any of the panelists on the overall recommendation six? If not, I think from that discussion, I think that's been a useful discussion. I think that dialogue allows the staff to have a look at some of those suggestions and look at incorporating some of those. So I think that's been helpful. And Peter, as the chair of the board, is informed that the board itself is planning to meet with the working group separately as well.
Probably tomorrow.
Don't know why I'm being a ventriloquist. So at that point, I'll close this session and thank everybody for attending.
Yeah, thank you.